Okay.
And
Great.
a lot of those are about as dull as they come. So, but we still have them. So, all right, great. So, thanks for agreeing to this. Thanks for agreeing to have it recorded. I guess I have kind of two categories of questions for you. And the first is very specific questions about that million saved study. And then the second is more general questions, just about, I would like to get your thoughts and feedback on our project and our process. So before I go into that, I mean, do you have any questions about GiveWell? Do you even have you looked at our website? It's okay if you haven't. I'm happy to give you kind of the quick overview. And do you have any questions that you just before we go?
I did look a little bit at your website. It sounds really interesting, and I have to say that I was very impressed with your shortcomings page.
Oh,
I thought that was terrific.
thanks. Okay. Yeah, I mean, basically, this is, one of the things that's important to know about GiveWell is that we started it as donors. So we used to work at a hedge fund, and we aren't experts in any particular area of aid. And the reason we're doing international aid is because we thought it was a really promising cause. After our first year, we said, this is a great cause. And so we don't have the kind of, we don't have expertise in this area. We're not hiding that. And what we do try to do is we've tried to really survey the literature and use that to see what the experts do say and why they say it and what the evidence is. And then we want to check what we think with people who do have spent a little bit more time in this area. So that would be more in the second category of questions, but but in the first category, it's just going to be a lot of specific questions I have about this million saved study. So I guess I'll get going on that if that's okay.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, great. So the first question I want to ask you is about a lot of things that are not included in this study, and I just wanted to hear your kind of, if off the top of your head, why they're not in there because they didn't fit one of the X criteria. It'd be great if you could just rattle that off. And if you don't know and there's something that it might be better for you to email me later, we can do that too.
Okay.
And so the first one is that one I emailed you. I emailed that to you because it was a link and I figured you might want to look at it so you knew what I was talking about first. And that's the WHO publishing their own list of success stories. Some of them are in Million Saved and some of them aren't, but a lot of them are not. And there's tuberculosis in a lot of countries other than China. There's a whole bunch of stuff on malaria. Which I don't think was any of the ones in Million Saved. And then there's some things on child survival. So were you familiar with that? And do you know, sort of why those weren't all there?
Yeah. So the broad answer is that the what got into Million Saved is very much related to the criteria that we used to select the cases, and the criteria were very explicit. I don't know if you've seen those criteria.
Yeah, I have those listed. So that's another one of my questions going to be on those, but I am familiar with them. You can assume that.
So if the intervention was large and done before Million Saved was published in 2004, we likely, or I wasn't there at the time, but the original working group likely discussed it and came up with a reason why it didn't meet one of these criteria. And one of the most problematic, I think there was a strong effort to get a malaria case into the original work, and most of the cases did not have enough documentation to demonstrate that the intervention was the reason for which there were decreases in malaria deaths or mortality or
In malaria.
morbidity afterwards.
Understand. Okay.
So sometimes that was for lack of documentation and poor research design, and sometimes that was because the impact just wasn't there, and it was hard for us to know which one of those two things it was, having not been intimately involved in the programs. But we did get a lot of so I was involved in the process of the revised Million Saved, which came out as a case studies book as kind of an academic edition that was supposed to go with a global health textbook. published by Jones and Bartlett. And so with that process, we tried to identify cases that didn't make it in the first time because they didn't have enough evidence or because they weren't completed yet. And we identified three new cases. So during that process, there were lots of proposals that came across my desk that just didn't pass muster for one of the many reasons. But usually the reason was inability to prove or demonstrate reasonably impact.
Yeah. I guess let me jump ahead for a second, because I do have a couple more questions on these lines. But you bring up the criteria that you had. And one of the things that I was wondering, I mean, I'm just thinking about, let me explain why we care so much about this and why we want to grill you on Million Saved, is that we think, you know, we're looking for interventions and programs that have some sort of a track record of having worked before. And that's the reason for that, is that we're trying to narrow the field of charities that we look at. And one of the things that's making us flag a charity for further investigation, and it's not the only thing, but if they are basically focused on doing something that has a track record of success. And so, you know, I understand that Million Saved is not necessarily comprehensive. I also understand that, you know, a lot of these programs, just because they worked in one country, doesn't mean they would work anytime anyone tried to do that. And I do understand that. However, you know, there seems to me to be a big difference between something that's worked and something that hasn't. And if we only stuck to sort of randomized controlled trials type microevidence criteria, I think we would be missing something. I think that I have an extra level of confidence in something that's kind of worked at the experimental level and at the kind of national level. And so, well, first off, that's the way we're using Million Saved. I mean, I would like your thoughts on that, whether you think that's appropriate or whether you think we're making some sort of mistake in thinking of it that way.
Randomized control trials were certainly not the only way in which a program got into Million Saved. There were lots of interventions that got in there without having experimental research designs attached to them.
Right. Let me just be totally clear. I mean, we separately recorded which ones are in Million Saved, and then we also did a, you know, totally separate process to find which ones had good microevidence.
So
to us, the ideal is something that, you know, like vaccines. Those are, you know, a lot of vaccines have been demonstrated in a randomized controlled trial, plus they're in Million Saved. That's really good. Something that's just in one or the other, that's okay. And then something that really there's neither is one of the ones where we don't see any reason to be particularly excited about it.
So, I'm sorry, what's your question?
So my question, well, first I just wanted to explain how we're using Million Saved, why it's important,
okay,
how it fits into our process,
sure,
and whether you think that's appropriate. Like, the, you know, And we're using it as kind of, this is our main source of info because we haven't found anything else really for things,
sure,
that kind of have worked at the macro level and even if not randomized controlled trial with like reasonably strong evidence. And the reason we're using that is to flag charities that focus on things like that.
Yeah, sure. I definitely think that's appropriate, in particular because the rigor with which these cases were chosen was high. So I think it's important to distinguish between procedural efficacy and, I guess, whether something actually works or not.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, a charity could be undertaking one of these interventions but not do it very well, and that's
yes,
a bad thing.
Yes.
Or, I guess that would be one.
I agree with you. So let me just spell it out a little bit more. I mean, what we've done is we made a list of interventions that appear in Million Saved or in our alternate list of more micro-based evaluations or both.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go through and we look for charities that either focus on programs like that or have, you know, documentation freely posted on their website of monitoring and evaluation. And charities that meet either of those two criteria get further investigated. And that's all it means. And from there, you know, we're really looking into whether they've got enough documentation of what they're doing to give us confidence. So we're not, you know, we're not recommending any charity just because it's, let's say, doing family planning and there's one case of family planning working well in one
yes,
country.
Yeah.
But that's the precise way we're doing it, is that we want a list of things that have worked before, and if we find a charity doing just those things, that gets them a flag. It gets them, you know, then they get further investigated. They stand out from the pile. That's all. So
yeah, it seems like a very appropriate use.
Right. So one of the concerns that I have, though, with that process is that when I look at the criteria that this study used, most of them look good to me and like criteria I would want to apply to any macro story. So certainly scale is exactly what we're looking for. I want something that's worked on a big scale. Health impact, yes, we're very into that, and we appreciate the focus on rigor in this paper, which is why we're using it. And then the ones that I am less sure we would want to narrow it down by are the ones, you know, one of them is importance. So, you know, what if there was a program, what if there was a successful program that wiped out a lot of lymphatic filariasis? I'm not quite sure I understand the importance criterion, but the way I'm reading it is that if the disease they attacked is not very high on the list of total burden in terms of DALYs, then it's going to get excluded. That seems like something we wouldn't want to miss. And then the other ones, you know, duration. I mean, if a program had a huge impact in 3 years, I would still want to consider that a success. And even cost effectiveness, I think cost effectiveness is important, but I mean, I would still be interested to know stories of things that had a big success and maybe weren't quite hitting the $100 per DALY threshold. So one thing I was going to ask you is, you know, is there any way we could get a list of the kind of things that met the other criteria where there was a big scale health impact, but maybe got excluded for one of those other three reasons? Is that available somewhere? Is there a way we could get that? Do you know how to do that? Or is that just something where we can't, you know, do that?
Gosh. Because I'm not physically there, don't think I have access to the files that have lists of cases excluded. But I can tell you that most cases got excluded for the impact reason.
Right.
Most cases that we would have even thought to consider were important, for example.
Okay.
I think that criteria was fairly weak. I mean, we wouldn't want to, because this is a developing country context, for example, we wouldn't care necessarily about interventions that are dealing with developed world diseases.
Right. Right, I see.
So that I would say that those are more the kinds of things that we would have excluded for that reason.
I see.
For example, there's a case on dental caries, and that may not be on the top of the list of DALYs, but dental caries, it was a very innovative program, and it worked, and people were better because of it. So I think that's an example of one where, you know, you might not think it's important, but we included it anyway.
Right.
Cost effectiveness, I'm not sure how many got excluded on the basis of that either. Things like, you know, XDR TB interventions that work may be ones that were just too costly to include.
Yep.
But I can't think off the top of my head of any others. I mean, this was really for, in particular, country governments that were looking to do well, that was one of the audiences, aside from donors, country governments in developing countries, and that's important for them, while it may not be quite as important for donors who don't have voters to hold them accountable.
Right, understood.
So, yeah.
So nothing, so you're saying nothing jumps to mind as something that was basically successful, had a big impact, but got left out because, you know, of importance or cost effectiveness or duration. Because that's
nothing jumps out to me. No, and I'm sure there are those lists somewhere, but I'm not at the office anymore, so I just don't have access to them.
No problem. So maybe do you mind if I just go through a few success stories that I've heard cited elsewhere, and maybe for each one you could just say to me one of three things, like never heard of that. Or, you know, heard of it, but couldn't you know, the evidence for impact wasn't there, or something else. You know, have heard of
sure,
it.
go ahead.
Okay, so the malaria, first off, I mean, that you told me that the recent malaria interventions, you know, you determined by the standards of millions saved were not showing impact. Does that include, like, I know this is pretty recent, but does that include, like, the Kenya program with insecticide-treated nets?
I don't think that was the malaria program we were really looking at. We were looking at the Brazil malaria program, and the problem there, it was a huge, it made a huge impact, but it was, the problem there was attributing the impact to the program itself.
Yep.
And not to some other environmental factors or population factors, something else. So that's why we just excluded the Brazil malaria case. I'm not sure if the Kenya one was large enough scale. I think that there were other net programs that were just getting going, and we didn't include them, I think, because of scale.
Okay. One of the ones I mentioned before, and I wondered if this one had more to do with the importance criterion. You know, we've seen, certainly in the disease control priorities report, states that lymphatic filariasis has been brought down very significantly in four countries that were doing mass administration of ivermectin and albendazole. Global Program to Eliminate Lymphatic Filariasis has a report that's, you know, reporting large declines in prevalence. On a related note, you know, Carter Center, onchocerciasis control efforts in Latin America, those are two guys that are, you know, reporting big drops in prevalence, massive drug administration for a particular disease, and the disease, you know, may not be the highest on the DALI list. Thoughts on that?
Didn't we have onchocerciasis in there?
You did, but not in Latin America.
Okay. So some of this was about just getting as vast an array of cases that we could. So if we have one onco case, we probably wouldn't have put the other.
Interesting. Okay.
This is also meant to be kind of a policy tool. One of the reasons that we started doing this was because there was a lot of skepticism on Capitol Hill about just how effective foreign aid dollars could be, and health was a particular place in which we thought that dollars for foreign aid could really be effective. So we wanted to go through a really rigorous process to demonstrate to Congress and other donors that this was something that was worthwhile. So part of the reason this wasn't meant to be comprehensive was because it was not necessarily targeted to an audience of public health professionals looking for what programs to do, but rather to make the policy point. Although it's useful for both purposes. As far as the LLF is concerned, I do remember considering that in the second round, and to be honest, I just don't remember why we excluded it. I'm sure there was a good reason for it. I don't know if it was scale or I doubt it was importance, because I think it's an important thing. But it may have been scale, and it may also have been impact. I'm guessing one of those two.
Okay. UNICEF Campaign for Child Survival. This is something that Jeffrey Sachs points to as a big success story. I don't know anything about it, so... Just off the top of your head, I mean, do you remember looking at that, or is that something you haven't looked at?
Well, I'm not sure what that means. I mean, we have a lot of interventions that comprise child survival interventions, vaccines and others. Child survival covers a huge range, so it may just have been too broad to do anything about.
Okay. I could email you that passage in his book where Jeffrey Sachs talks about that. So maybe that's the best way to leave that. I mean, it's not terribly specific. It's capitalized. So I don't think it's general. I think it's a particular campaign promoting a package of interventions known as GOBI, growth monitoring, ORT, breastfeeding, and immunization. So I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, and also given that it's such a diverse menu of interventions, it's possible that the ability to attribute success to any one of those things may be difficult.
Yep.
That may be, have been a problem.
Okay. You mentioned before, I just wanted to hit this, that, you know, if there's one Onco story, you might not cover other Onco stories. I mean, is that a general... You said, you know, since this was kind of a policy tool, that was kind of a general thing. So that raises questions to me. You know, three of the questions I was going to ask is, I've seen much broader successes claimed for oral rehydration therapy, family planning, and polio kind of across the globe, whereas all these were about one country. So is that kind of your answer to that? Okay.
That's absolutely the answer. And I think the reason we made the choice to make these about specific successes was so we could learn from those successes, what were the mechanisms at work driving them, and we have those conclusions at the end. And I don't think we could have done that had we focused so broadly.
Okay, got it. Just two more to mention. These are both like a long time ago, from like the 1950s and 60s. Malaria control. I've read that you know, drastically reduced the burden of malaria. But maybe that's
where is that?
Attribute thing. I think worldwide, but I could look up exactly where it was said.
That may be reflective of the Brazil case, which I was talking about earlier. Was one of these that we went back and forth, and you know, that there were experts who were in the field in the 60s doing this work and have written published papers in reputable journals about how well it worked. And for a number of reasons, the group of people on the working group, I think this was another real benefit of the working group, is that we had a really diverse cadre of public health professionals and policy experts making decisions about whether these passed muster. And so we got lots of perspectives, and if there wasn't a consensus, then it didn't go through. And
Okay. One more, yaws control.
Drastic. I'm sorry, what was that?
Yaws, YAWS. Just you know, another 50s and 60s control program where the prevalence fell a lot. I mean, again, I don't know. I think it was a worldwide program, or wherever yaws was endemic, and I don't know about the impact data, but just wanted to see if it rang a bell.
It doesn't.
Okay, no problem. So the next thing I want to ask about is kind of the flip side of this. So actually, before I get into that, let me just understand a little bit better the impact measure. So I did read these pretty carefully, and I do have kind of a general sense, but, you know, is there any one sort of criterion you have for demonstrating impact, you know, actually attributable to the program, or was it just sort of whatever the group of experts found convincing? Because I noticed there's a lot of different sorts of cases being made. You know, in some cases there's sort of like in TB in China, you've got almost a comparison group situation. And in other cases, you've got more, I know with maternal mortality, sort of like analyzing the types of mortality falling. I mean, just very different methods to do it. So was there any kind of list of methods that are considered valid, or was it more just whatever the experts found convincing?
That's a really good question. So I don't think that there's a list, but I do think that an overriding question was, can this answer the counterfactual question?
Right.
What else is going on in that country that may have contributed to this result? And if there even was something else going on, is the result so drastic that it's really believable that part of it was attributable to the intervention?
Right.
So I think that question is in academia is always addressed by clinical trials or some experimental or quasi-experimental design. In this case, we had a much wider plurality of methods that we accepted, and it could have been just really extensive observational documentation of what was going on at the time and what happened afterwards. I guess there just had to be enough to make it believable, and that could have been a number of things. So I guess it's not a very specific answer to your question, but
no, that answers my question. That's exactly what I was looking for. that does bring me to my next question, which is that I am also very concerned about counterfactual question. And so I kind of, you know, did a vetting of the 20 case studies and said what they wrote about that counterfactual question. And a lot of them addressed the question head on and had what I thought were very good answers. So, you know, examples of that would be definitely tuberculosis control in China, you know, the sort of the one on saving mothers' lives in Sri Lanka. Actually, quite a few of these I thought were very good. Then there were some that just didn't address this question at all. And so the first set that didn't seem to address it was the ones, I think almost none of the stories, I'm pretty sure none of the ones involving eradication or elimination of a disease address that question of what else might have caused that elimination. And, mm-hmm. you know, perhaps that's because there was a consensus that a disease doesn't just go away by itself, which I would think is possible. But I wanted to kind of push you on that and see if that's right or if there's more to the story.
Yeah, I think you're probably right in that assumption that the counterfactual just wasn't as important when there was no apparent trend in the problem being, and then if it all of a sudden went away, it probably influenced them.
Yeah. I mean, hang on, let me just write this, let me just take a note on this, but like I do agree the burden is lower. At the same time, like, even for an elimination story, like, I personally would want to see one of two things. Like, one, that it wasn't the continuation of a trend that was already in place before the program.
Right.
Or two, that, like, I would like to see something capturing the general improvement in living standards or, you know, the progress of another disease unrelated to the program and see that that didn't look the same. And so, you know, that's, those were not, even that level was not in these stories. So I wonder if it was just maybe not, you know, discussed but not included or what?
Yeah, no, I, for all the elimination stories, those were written the first time around, so I don't know how those decisions gotten that would be counterfactual. So I can only guess, and my guess would be that they were just so obviously attributable to the program
right.
that they didn't include them. I think you're right that it would have been nice to have included along the lines that you're talking about. So I'm not sure if it was a conscious decision or unconscious.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then there are a few that that didn't address it at all for me, and you know, they were just to, I'll just list them and see if you have anything that springs to mind off the top of your head, or if you know the right person to talk to kind of push on these more. You know, the onchocerciasis in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, I didn't even see how the data was collected or what data they even used. And so I, you know, didn't address the counterfactual question. ORS in Egypt didn't discuss that. Iodine deficiency in China. Again, I didn't even see anything about what data they collected, much less how they addressed the counterfactual. And then,
sorry, which one in China?
Iodine deficiency. You know, it said they iodized the salt, but it didn't say anything about measuring iodine deficiency.
Yeah.
Or at least specifically how they did it. And then there were two that were a little, you know, dental caries in Jamaica and cataracts in India. Both of these were kind mm-hmm. of, they kind of stated that they addressed the counterfactual, but they didn't give a reference or be specific. So, you know, these are just ones that I wonder about a little bit. It's not a big deal. Like, I think I was happy enough with what I saw that we're willing to use this study and we're planning to use it. But if you had thoughts off the top of your head or knew who the right person to talk to about those would be, that'd be... All right. So I do still have a couple questions that you might be able to answer on this and then move to the general stuff. Did you, while you were working on this, or just in general, did you come across any failure stories? Because we're interested in those too, and especially with us, you know, a lot of the struggle we have is kind of convincing individual donors that charity is not automatically great and not automatically a success, that you do have to be critical and hold people accountable, and the measurement is important. So, you know, did you come across any, or do you know of any cases where a big health initiative failed?
Gosh, that's a really good question, and I'm sure that we did, but I can't remember anything off the top of my head. At the moment,
Okay.
I know that we toyed around with publishing something about it, but then just thought it would be too politically incorrect.
Well, that'd be great if we could get our hands on that, because we would happily publish it under our name. But
yeah, that's absolutely a great question. And I think one big problem with that question is it's really hard to find evidence.
Right, right, because usually they don't want to share it. I mean, a variation on this question would be, do you know of any big public health initiatives that, even if they weren't shown to be failures, maybe just kind of flamed out, just kind of, you know, we're going strong and we're a big plan to rid the world of something, and then just kind of stopped, ended?
Yeah. The other thing you might want to look for on this question is ones that had really perverse consequences.
Ones that what?
Ones that had really perverse consequences.
Right. I agree, but I think those might be harder to find than the one I'm asking now, which is like, you know, are there any that just kind of disappeared, even if we don't know exactly what the impact
is? Yeah.
So you think
you're
the right person to ask? Okay. And
but I can tell you that we saw lots of evidence in the process of doing this that when things did fail, those results got covered up almost systematically across the board in lots of different agencies. So that's why I think in determining which agency you're going to work with, looking at the way in which they monitor and evaluate their programs is critical, because even if they're doing things that aren't working, if they're being honest about that and making changes to their policies as a result, then that's fine. But that's very unusual. So I think something to think about is the independence with which the programs are being evaluated, if their salaries depend on failures and things like that.
Yeah, well, that's a good segue into the more general questions I wanted to just get your thoughts on, because that, I have to say, I mean, from what we've seen, that's incredibly rare, that a charity specifically is sharing its successes and failures, you know, with equal transparency. Most charities, you will look at their website and you'll see a lot of general statements, you'll see some sort of anecdotal, you know, individual success stories. But what you won't see is any kind of monitoring and evaluation. And when you do, it's generally highly stylized, highly selective. It's not technical.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I described to you before how we're trying to deal with this, is that we are looking for charities that either are doing something that has worked before, in which case we go to them and say, you know, we actually take the initiative ourselves to really push them for more monitoring and evaluation data, because we feel that the hurdle might be lower. Or we look for charities that are voluntarily sharing, you know, a lot of their stuff, especially in technical form. And then, you know, I think where we end up doing this and what ends up happening is that we have found some charities, and I'll tell you what they are in a second, that they do, you know, they do publish many of their reports in a technical form, maybe not all, but certainly many, like at least enough to account for, let's say, half of their expenses overall. And you can look at those reports and see that generally it looks like the money's being used as intended, and most of the common sense questions you would ask are being answered. So, you know, for bednets, that would be following up with a survey to ask people if they slept under a net last night every couple of years. For condoms, that would be surveying people on attitudes towards sex, knowledge about how it's transmitted, reported use of condoms. And so we find that, you know, we don't have perfect transparency. We don't have anything like randomized controlled trials or, you know, super convincing analysis that, and we also always have these questions about whether, you know, whether they're overfunded, whether they, you know, are going to take more dollars and do more of what they do. But if we can find an organization that it can show us at least that level of documentation for the majority of its activities, then we do figure that more money is going to translate to more of that, and that we can bet on that organization with a good deal of confidence. So that's our basic process. It's, you know, that's the work we've been doing, and wanted your general thoughts on whether that's reasonable.
Yeah, I think that sounds good. I think some things to add to that would be, what are program managers held accountable to and for, and how much learning happens within the organization. So one thing that we saw that's really difficult is for organizations that do this kind of work to learn, because so much of the time the money is so disconnected from the program itself. So if there's mechanisms within the organization for bad programs to get cut off, for good programs to get more funding, or even just for that communication to happen where the manager is able to say to the director, you know, this really isn't going so well, and not get attacked for it. That is really key to, it may be really hard to find, but maybe interviews or something would give you that kind of information.
Great. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. You know, and that is one of the things that we do look for, especially with a lot of these re-granting organizations like Global Health Partnerships. Yeah. We look for evidence that, you know, if someone is not meeting the grant criteria, that the money gets cut off, because that seems to be something that often does not happen as it should. So the charities right now that are at the top of our list are the Stop Tuberculosis Partnership, out of the WHO. We think is really quite a standout in terms of how much monitoring and evaluation they do, how much they post.
Yep.
In addition, they're working on, you know, what sort of the Copenhagen Consensus authors consider the best buy in health, in disease control. And, you know, they're also donating drugs, which does not eliminate concerns about how the funds are being used, but certainly ameliorates them to some degree. They're giving governments drugs instead of money. Then they, you know, they make them go through an audit of whether they're carrying out the DOTS program successfully. And then and then we even saw a couple examples where governments sort of were found to be failing, and then they didn't get more funding. So we thought stuff really stood out, and even you know, even more celebrated partnerships such as Gavi and the Global Fund, I don't think can make a lot of the statements I just made. And so that's, it's kind of our top global health partnership and one of our top charities so far. Another couple that we think are great, we're looking into the Against Malaria Foundation. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
What is it called?
The Against Malaria Foundation out of the UK.
No, I don't know it.
They're pretty simple. I mean, they re-grant and they provide funding to distribute bed nets. But what we like is that they're really, they make someone apply for funding for bed nets. They answer a bunch of questions about how they're going to target the vulnerable, how they're going to track use, etc. And then that's posted online. The status of the distribution is posted online, like in real time. Like you can see if it's on the boat or whatever. And then once they get there, the charities submit a follow-up report where they take pictures of the bed nets hanging up in the rooms. And so it's not perfect, but being that bed nets are something that appears to have had some success in the past, even if it's not included in the Million Saved study, and considering that these guys, you know, are very consistently at least showing that the bed nets got to where they were supposed to get, we think that's more you can get out of a lot of charities. And then finally, Population Services International, they do social marketing of condoms and bed nets mostly. That's about 75% of their expenses. Then they do a bunch of other products. They do follow-up surveys. They don't publish all the follow-up surveys, but they publish a lot of them. They don't cover all their areas, but they cover a lot of them. And we think the interventions they're doing have some kind of track record and what it all makes sense. So those are kind of our top, and I'd like to hear if you have any thoughts on those and if there's anyone that you think is really good that you want to make sure we look at.
Actually, PSI is one of the ones that I would have said, I think in part because they seem to be really focused on collecting data and analyzing it. So I only know that anecdotally from people that I've known who've worked there. But let's see, other things. You know, another way to find these kinds of organizations is also to look at who's funding and what kind of regulations that they have. I know that so Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was really a partner in the Million Saved project. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of donors like them, like the Hewlett Foundation, that are intimately concerned with the ability to demonstrate impact and the ability to be really effective. And I think a more rigorous fashion than a lot of other donors. So I think organizations that work with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and some of these other donors may have a better track record because they've had these kind of conversations with their donors about at least wanting to implement programs that actually work, which is actually not the standard that's sometimes used in in the global health and global development. So
unfortunately, I know exactly what you're
and
talking.
That's partly because so the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has a lot of people working for them who are researchers and have this background of doing things in a rigorous fashion. So I think that's part of it. And then I don't know if you know anything about the impact evaluation working group that started at the Center for Global Development and is now actually its own kind of thing. Have you heard about this or read about it?
I so many of these guys have similar names. I'm actually Googling it now to see if it's something that I've seen before. Is this the like
IIIE, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was actually like my project that I worked more specifically on at the center. So I can tell you a lot more about that than I can about Million Saved. But but I think what's important for you is any donor that was involved in that working group is probably that's probably a signal to you that organizations that they fund are going to be fairly progressive in this particular way.
Great.
That these are the donors that are having conversations about demonstrating actual impact. So.
All right, good. That makes a lot of sense. Thanks. Any other specific charities you would recommend? Although we can check those out.
Any specific what?
Any other specific charities you would recommend?
So, I know a lot less about charities and a lot more about donors.
Right.
So I can't really say. I mean, I think that in general, charities just have really hard time. I mean, the system is. I've worked with some on the ground and through donors, and I think that they're just fighting an uphill battle against inefficiency because, you know, they're recreating systems on the ground, and they're with a local work culture that is really different from their own, and they're being held accountable by lots of different forces that many of which are not concerned with efficiency at all. So, it's really hard to judge charities to an ideal of efficiency. I guess it's maybe more fair to judge them against each other.
Yep. That's what we try to do. I mean, our basic mission here at GiveWell is to say, look, you know, if we just made up an ideal of how we thought they should be, that would be ignorant and then we would end up recommending no one. But you know, these guys, StopTB, PSI, AMF, I think they do stand out from the crowd in terms of how much I bet that they're getting it done with the money. If we can get people to donate to them, because of that, then that is a starting to change the incentives for other charities to operate more like that and put the focus more on transparency and more on demonstrating impact than a lot of the other ways that charities raise money.
I don't know if you're tapped into the the social venture capitalist group. There are a lot of them are in the Bay Area. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about. We're not, you know, one of the differences between us and that kind of group is that we're really looking for kind of the big scalable charity that we can recommend to someone who's got, you know, $100, $1,000, $10,000. So, you know, we're not sitting here building charities. We're finding charities that are already built.
I guess they are, though, thinking about a lot of these same questions.
Yep.
I don't know if they have lots of working groups about these kinds of things. So I don't know if it would be useful at all ever to, because you probably come from similar backgrounds as theirs. I don't know if it would be at all useful to talk to people like at the Acumen Fund. I know that there is a working group among them of figuring out how to make aid more effective or accountable or something. So they're having these conversations in just a different forum, but it might be interesting to tap into that.
Great. Yeah, that's a good suggestion. Thank you. Okay. Hey, a quick question. Since you said you were somewhat familiar with Population Services International.
Yep.
Here's a quick question. I agree with you about looking at who funds someone. They seem to be pretty unusual in terms of where they get their funding, in that they seem to be funded entirely, almost, by... I mean, they do get a decent amount of donations from individuals, which is why we consider them relevant, but they get a ton of their funding from governments, and that's kind of mm-hmm. governments all over the world, government agencies, that usually don't have a reputation... A, for being very impact-focused, and B, a lot of these agencies have a reputation for kind of making everyone dance to their tune. And yet, PSI seems very impact-focused, and they seem to be doing their own pretty coherent strategy that, you know, most of what they do is pretty consistent. It's a set number of programs, so they seem to be breaking some sort of pattern. I don't... Another weird thing about them is that they maintain a very low level of assets, you know, like savings, which makes me think that, you know, they're kind of counting on these guys to fund them every year because they don't seem to be saving for a rainy day. So it's just uh-huh. an unusual situation. I mean, I don't care to freak out too much about it because it looks like they are doing what's, you know, they're doing a good job and they're doing what's important, but it seems unusual given who their funders are, what their situation is. So I wonder if you had any thoughts on that.
I don't know anymore about their funding situation.
Okay.
Sorry.
Cool. We're going to ask them anyway, but I just think we might have some thoughts on that.
Yeah.
One kind of random question I have for you, too. I mean, the two of us have been kind of discussing and agreeing a lot on the importance of impact and evaluation. There is a set of charities that I kind of look at them and I kind of wonder, you know, do they really need to meet the same burden of proof as a lot of other ones? So just to give very concrete examples of what I mean, you know, Partners in Health, they go and they build a hospital in a rural area. And so yeah. they take pictures of what the hospital looked like before and afterward. And, you know, before there's basically nothing there. And so it seems to me like unless you're just totally incompetent, if you can run a decent hospital with people from the West who basically, you know basic medicine and, you know, you're probably making a big difference in people's lives. And I do want to know the specifics of how the money's being spent and who's being treated. But, you know, I don't require the same kind of analysis that I often would want
yeah. to. I guess the question there is rather the choice of that specific intervention against potential alternatives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, would it have been more effective to support small clinics throughout that area instead of building a big expensive hospital? Or, you know, I don't you can think of a lot of different alternatives. So
right.
that may be the question to ask there rather than is hospital getting built for the right amount of money.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a cost effectiveness question, which, you know, due to the difficulty of even getting confidence on effectiveness, we tend to put mm-hmm. cost effectiveness kind of second in our, you know, we do care about it. We want to make sure that everyone's in the right ballpark, that someone's not, you know, spending $10,000 per person served, because that would kind of kill a lot of the reason you want to do international aid in the first place.
Yeah.
But we do, you know, I wonder, Partners in Health is currently one of our recommended organizations. I'm trying to think through whether they should be for the next round. And, you know, on one hand, uh-huh. They don't document very much about what they do. On the other hand, they're running a hospital, which is very different from trying to teach people to change their behavior. And so I wonder,
yeah.
you know.
You may want to ask them about their choice to do that particular intervention. I think that's where the interesting questions arise is
yeah.
why they chose that. And that's been kind of the motto of Partners in Health is to do big bang, high impact, really expensive things in a few discrete
right.
locations rather than, you know. So I think that's more of a
cost effectiveness thing. Yeah.
Yes, I guess you could narrow it down to cost effectiveness, but it's also how you believe funding should work. I mean, should we be taking our technology and just planting it in places like this, or should we be supporting governments, or there's lots of choices that need to be made at the outset, and I think they make different choices than many organizations do, and it could be that that's the better choice, and it could be not. So that might be something interesting to look at.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, similar. I think this, you're probably gonna have very similar comments about this, but we also look at organizations that will do, you know, pretty complicated, expensive surgeries. So like fistula surgery, cleft palate, lip surgery. And, you know, on one hand, you could say, well, you know, they're not really, it might not be the most cost-effective thing you could do. On the other hand, you know, again, there's a certain straightforwardness to it. It's like as long as the doctors are competent and they do the surgery, the person's sitting right there when they do the surgery, and you can see the effects. And so it's not like a big vertical distribution program of some medicine where there's a huge question about whether people are taking the medicine and whether it's working as intended.
Yeah.
You know, or even less straightforward programs that are trying to, you know, get people to raise their incomes, and you've got this whole question of whether they're changing their behavior. You know, you're just fixing someone's deformity.
Yeah.
And so we...
Again, I guess that's part of the duration criteria that we use, is to think somewhat about sustainability. That's hard because some of these interventions don't have the goal of being sustainable, nor should they, but... I worry about these high-cost, one-time interventions. If they're not building sustainability, if you're going to get the same problem back at the same magnitude in the years to come.
Well, you know what the rejoinder to that would be is, this is something that I've definitely seen argued by, like, William Easterly, for example, that that sustainability is an admirable goal, but it's really one without a track record. That's a claim that I've seen. You know, a paper called The Illusion of Sustainability makes that claim, says basically sustainability is a great idea, but there's no examples of donors really creating a sustainable project, so why are we still aiming for this? Why don't we just try to improve people's lives?
If you look at the vitamin A case, that built or that promoted women, volunteer workers in communities, you'll see that those volunteers were sustainable because they were enmeshed in a social norms that gave them incentive to continue doing their work, and that their position was flexible enough that they were able to undertake other health interventions, not the one that they were set up to do in the first place. So the track record is short. But I don't think it's non-existent, and it may be that this is a new kind of giving that governments and donors are wanting to get into. For example, there's a larger shift, particularly in Europe, toward government budget support, and that may be because they think that's the more sustainable approach rather than planting U.S. workers and money in the country where they want it to be. So it's a huge debate, but it's probably something to consider.
Yeah. Do you have any, first on that question, I mean, is that a case where kind of the people were able to stop the flow of donor money entirely and it continued going, or are you more just pointing to the fact that, you know, the women were trained to carry out a certain part of it and then the training only had to be done once?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether the funding was revoked entirely, but the fact that they then started doing other things, I think, is a good sign. And I don't have any other examples off the top of my head, but I'm sure that they're out there.
Do you have any thoughts on where to find them? Because I see
on where to find them.
People are saying that it doesn't exist, and I talk to people and say they don't exist, but I would love to see the examples because it would change our view.
Yeah. You might ask, people giving money at donor organizations who are enlightened about this, like maybe DFID. You could ask a donor organization that is doing budget support why they think that this this is going to be more sustainable, and if they have records that it is,
yeah,
that's one place to look.
Okay.
I actually have to run.
Okay, no problem. That was all the specific questions I had, and so I, you know, wanted to see if you have anything else to add about what we should keep in mind, but I'm also happy to let you go.
No, if I think of anything, I'll let you know. I do think that if this is the kind of thing that interests you, I would follow what's going on with IIIE, because I think that this will be a continued form for identifying both interventions and organizations that do good work.
Okay.
Or at least care about the kind of rigor that you care about.
Okay, great. And, you know, before you do go, I would just like to put in, you know, that I think that the issue we're looking at is one that, in my opinion, doesn't get enough attention, which is what can a donor do with $1,000? It's something that, you know, really allows you to have a direct impact on what happens in a more direct and kind of, you know, distinct way than the policy stuff. And so, you know, I would like to just put in a pitch that hopefully you'll stay in touch with us, continue to follow our project, and maybe talk to us again in the future, review our report when it comes out. That would all be very helpful to us, and I think, you know, a good opportunity for you, I hope.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. It's great to see that you're definitely an innovative organization, and I think one for which there's a need. So I will keep track.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Have a good day.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay, too. Bye.